The sound of music faded into the memory of dust. What happens when a nation forgets the foundational laws given by its God, the Odd, and instead begins to operate purely on impulse, pursuing whatever momentary desire or strategy feels correct? Cities crumble. New, often reluctant, heroes are forged in fire. Enemies multiply and close in. And the people, drowning in the chaos of their own making, repeatedly lift their voices in desperate cries for salvation. This is no pastoral fable of heroes and happy endings. This is a gritty chronicle of warfare, profound betrayals, fierce vengeance, and unexpected miracles. It is the true, raw story of fundamentally flawed warriors, of unexpectedly fearless women, and of a persistent God who, despite provocation, refuses to abandon the covenant he made with his chosen people. From men who battled lions barehanded to women who became assassins with humble tent pegs. From twisted, terrible oaths to the grim justice delivered by a woman crushing a king with a simple millstone. This is the wildest, darkest, and most brutally human book within the sacred texts. This is the Book of Judges, presented in a way that reveals its terrifying depth. After the passing of Joshua, the formidable leader who had successfully ushered the Israelite tribes across the Jordan and into the Promised Land, an unnerving silence descended upon the people. There was no authoritative successor, no Moses, no Joshua, only the crushing weight of existential questions. Who would command them now? They gazed upon the mountainous strongholds, the deep valleys, and the strategically vital cities that remained stubbornly under enemy rule. They possessed the title deed to the land, yes, but the conquest was far from complete. The battles were ongoing, urgent, and necessary. So they resorted to their last and best resource, prayer. Lord, they implored, which tribe among us should advance first to confront the Canaanites? And God provided a directive answer, simple yet utterly divine. Let the tribe of Judah go first. I have already delivered this land into their hands. Armed with this divine commission, the seasoned warriors of Judah approached their kin, the tribe of Simeon, and made a plea for unity. Fight alongside us, they said. Help us seize our allocated portion of the land, and when your turn comes, we will fight for you. This necessary, pragmatic alliance was the true face of brotherhood in a broken world. They moved together, and their first great test came at a place called Bezek, where they engaged a formidable tyrant, King Adonibezek, a veteran warrior, notorious for his brutality and universally feared. But the unwavering hand of God protected and strengthened Judah. They annihilated his forces and successfully captured the king himself. In an act that was both shocking in its violence and chillingly symbolic, they severed his thumbs and the great toes of his feet. Barbaric? Perhaps. But listen to the king's confession, delivered while his wounds bled freely. I did precisely this to 70 other kings, he gasped. I cut off their thumbs and toes, forcing them to feed beneath my table. Now the God of Israel has repaid me in kind for my own cruelty. They escorted the defeated monarch to Jerusalem, where he died, stripped of his crown and his former tyrannical power. Judah's army pressed on, sweeping through the hills and the arid plains. Everywhere they went, the Lord was demonstrably with them. Yet not every territory was winnable. When they encountered enemies equipped with the devastating iron chariots, armored, heavy machines of war that symbolized overwhelming technological superiority, they faltered. Even Judah, despite their celebrated bravery, could not overcome that immense, metallic barrier. Still, the divine plan was in motion elsewhere. An old warrior, legendary for his loyalty, was ready to make one final, indelible mark. Caleb, yes, the same Caleb who had bravely scouted the land decades earlier in the days of Moses, stood tall. He issued a compelling challenge. Whoever successfully attacks and captures the powerful city of Kiriath Sefer shall be given my daughter Aksa in marriage. It was a challenge tied to an extraordinary reward. A young man named Othniel stepped forward. He was Caleb's nephew, but he did not rely on family legacy. He relied on sheer, unadulterated courage. He fought, he conquered, and he earned Aksa's hand. She was no ordinary bride. Bold and astute, she immediately instructed him, "Ask my father for land, but specifically, for land blessed with water. Caleb generously granted the request, providing both the upper springs and the lower springs. This was not merely land. It was sustainable life, a victory compounded by foresight. The tribes moved forward, Judah and Simeon together, conquering a city named Zephath, reducing it to ashes, and symbolically renaming it Hormah, destruction. It was a warning carved in the permanence of fire and ash. But not all the tribes displayed such resolve. Benjamin lacked the necessary strength or perhaps the will to drive out the Jebusites who held Jerusalem. Instead of achieving victory, they settled into a fateful pattern of coexistence, choosing to live alongside their enemies. Meanwhile, Joseph's people, led by Ephraim, spied on the city of Bethel. They found a man, made him a treacherous deal. "Show us the secret way in, and we will spare your life." He complied. They spared him. He departed, building a new city elsewhere, calling it Luz. Mercy, perhaps, but more likely a clear sign that the Israelites were already learning the dangerous art of compromise. Tribe after tribe mirrored this weakening resolve. Manasseh, Ephraim, Zebulun, Asher, Naphtali, none of them completed the purging of the land as commanded. They permitted the Canaanites to live among them. Some tribes, seeking a shortcut to economic stability and power, even forced the remaining Canaanites into servitude. This was a strategy born of human expedience, a path explicitly not sanctioned by God. The tribe of Dan attempted to hold their territory, but the Amorites proved too formidable and pushed the Danites back, confining them to the desolate hills. The fertile valleys, the places of easy sustenance, were lost. Only much later, when the combined might of the tribe of Joseph grew overwhelming, were they able to force the Amorites into servitude. It was a late-won victory, yet still a far cry from the complete, uncompromising obedience God had demanded. And so, the stage was tragically set. The people were scattered, holding only half-victories, their loyalties divided, the land partially claimed but entirely dangerous. The Israelites were learning a bitter lesson. Simply having a divine promise does not guarantee its realization without unwavering fidelity. God had gifted them the land, but now came the true test. Would they trust him fully? Would they obey without compromising the covenant? Would they remember the mighty one who led them out of Egypt, through the Red Sea, and across the Jordan? Or would the memories of divine power begin to fade? That is how the book of Judges truly begins, not with the pomp of coronation, but with an open, terrifying question. Who will provide spiritual and physical leadership when there is no recognized king? Before long, something extraordinary shattered the oppressive silence. Out of the dust of compromise, out of a generation already dangerously forgetting its roots, God dispatched a messenger. An angel of the Lord descended, appearing not to a king or a high prophet, but directly to the mass of the people themselves. He traveled from Gilgal, that sacred place of memory where Israel had first stepped foot into the promised land, where memorial stones had been stacked high in remembrance of the Jordan crossing. Step by deliberate step, the angel walked until he reached a small, obscure town called Bochim. There he stood, and his voice cut through the air like a streak of lightning across the still sky. "I brought you up out of Egypt," he declared. "I personally led you into the land I swore to your ancestors. I said, I will never break my covenant with you." The people stopped, stunned into silent realization of the presence of the divine. "I explicitly commanded you, do not make any treaties or alliances with the inhabitants of this land, and you must break down their pagan altars. But you have not obeyed my voice." The silence deepened, heavy with guilt. The angel's voice, though powerful, cracked, not from weakness, but from profound sorrow and disappointment. "What is this devastating thing you have done?" He was not asking for information he lacked. He was asking so that the horrific nature of their failure would echo in their own souls. "So now I also declare, I will no longer drive these nations out before you. They will remain, and they will become sharp thorns in your sides, acting as traps for your feet. Their gods will become snares that ensnare your hearts." The words landed like thunder. A covenant had been irrevocably violated, not by God, but by his own people, and the consequences would be immediate and severe. Suddenly, a strange, visceral thing happened. Something deeply raw and human. The Israelites lifted their voices in communal lamentation, weeping hysterically. Right there, in the presence of divine disappointment and righteous anger, they cried out with the overwhelming grief of a guilty heart finally recognizing its sin. They named the place Bochim, the Weepers, and there, they offered sacrifices to the Lord, not out of mere ritual or habit, but out of genuine mourning, out of brokenness, and out of a desperate, fleeting desire to truly return to their God. But would this repentance last? Soon after, the tragic cycle began its first rotation. Joshua, the faithful leader, the warrior of promise, had died. He was laid to rest in the hills of Timnath-Serah, a quiet resting place among the inheritance he had fought to secure. With him passed the final generation that had seen God move with raw power, the ones who had walked through the parted waters, who had tasted the miraculous fall of walls at Jericho. But the next generation, they did not know the Lord. They had not seen the Red Sea split in half. They had not witnessed the sun stand still over Gibeon. They had never stood trembling at the fiery, glorious foot of Mount Sinai. And so, the inevitable happened. They began to forget. They forgot the terrible power of the one who pulled them from Egyptian bondage. They forgot the tender mercy that rained down manna every morning. They forgot the demanding justice that burned against Pharaoh. And into that gaping void of forgetfulness crept idols. Baal, Ashtaroth, foreign names whispering tempting promises. The people bowed low to carved wood and cold stone, to gods that possessed eyes but could not truly see, ears but could not hear the cries of the faithful, mouths but could not speak a word of truth. The Lord witnessed this spiritual infidelity, and his anger flared hot. These people, he decreed, have swiftly turned away from the path I commanded them. They pursue false gods and break my covenant. So he withdrew his protective hand. No more effortless victories. No more guaranteed triumphs. Now, when they marched to battle, they fell. When they desperately cried out for help, only agonizing silence echoed back. Yet, even within the confines of judgment, God's mercy flickered like a stubborn flame refusing to die. He raised up judges, not kings draped in golden robes, but humble, often flawed men and women infused with the Spirit of the Lord. These judges rose, they fought, they delivered Israel from oppression. And for a time, the people followed God. But as soon as the judge died, the people inevitably slid right back into sin. A worse sin, a deeper rebellion. It became a devastating, maddening, predictable cycle. Obedience, memory fading, idolatry, defeat, crying out, salvation, temporary peace, then forgetting all over again. The Lord observed their predictable hearts, and he spoke once more. Because this nation has violated the covenant I laid down for their ancestors, I will no longer drive out the nations Joshua left behind. I will use these enemies to test Israel, to see if they will commit to walking in my ways. Thus the Canaanites remained. The Philistines, the Sidonians, the Amorites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, they stayed. Not because God was weak, but because his people were. They had failed the test of faith, and now the hostile world pressed in closer. The promised land was populated by Israel, but it was not free. God's people lived among the very enemies they were commanded to annihilate. Enemies who whispered in foreign tongues, who bowed to carved gods, and who waited for weakness. And the Israelites began to change. They didn't merely live alongside these nations. They actively married into them. They gave their daughters to pagan sons and took foreign wives for themselves. And with those marital unions came something infinitely worse than shared homes or customs. The worship of false gods. The children of the God of Abraham were now kneeling to Baal, burning sweet incense to Ashtaroth, and building altars to comforting, convenient lies. So the Lord, whose heart burned with both justice and a jealous love for his people, allowed the natural consequence to unfold. From the distant east came a king, Cushan-Rishathaim of Mesopotamia. His notorious name literally meant double wickedness. And he lived up to every dark letter of the title. He crossed borders, seized key cities, and dominated the demoralized tribes. For 8 long years, Israel served him, not as allies, not as neighbors, but as slaves. God's people, once destined for freedom, now lived under a cruel and foreign fist. But suffering has a strange, violent way of stirring forgotten memory. And the people remembered. They remembered Egypt and how God broke their chains. They remembered the Red Sea miracle. They remembered their sacred covenant. And from that deep place of pain, they did what desperate people always do. They cried out, not to Baal, not to Ashtaroth. They cried out to the Lord. And God, merciful even when wronged, heard them. He raised up a man, not a prophet, not a wealthy prince, but a warrior named Othniel. It was the same Othniel who had earlier conquered Kiriath Sefer, the same man who had won the courageous heart of Aksa. The Othniel who had once been hungry for a challenge was now filled with the very spirit of the Lord, rising to become Israel's first great judge. He did not come with iron chariots or with elaborate political schemes. He came with a fire in his bones and the visible hand of God resting on his back. Othniel gathered the people, rallied the fragmented tribes, and stood directly against Cushan-Rishathaim, the double wicked king. He fought not with fear or compromise, but with absolute faith, and God granted him total victory. Othniel struck down the oppressor, shattered his dominance, and Israel was free once more. Peace swept over the land like a cleansing wind. Not for a brief day, not for a single season, but for 40 uninterrupted years. A generation matured under Othniel's guidance, safe, strong, and momentarily faithful. And then he died, quietly, without the drama of a throne, just a man who obeyed God and gave his people peace. But peace is terrifyingly fragile when memory fails. Without Othniel to lead and discipline them, the Israelites began the slow, deadly process of forgetting once more. Forget who had liberated them. Forget who had blessed them. Forget who they were meant to be. Othniel was gone, and with him went the discipline, the spiritual vision, and the moral spine of the people. Israel collapsed again like a house built on sand. They committed evil in God's sight, not out of ignorance, but out of habit, out of deliberate choice, out of rebellion. So the Lord handed them over to a new king from an old, familiar enemy. Eglon, the corpulent king of Moab, a man synonymous with indulgence and appetite. He formed a deadly alliance with the Ammonites and the Amalekites. Together, they struck with the speed of a desert storm. They crossed the Jordan and seized the city of palm trees, Jericho. The very first place Israel had conquered was now humiliatingly lost. For 18 dreadful years, Israel served Eglon, a king whose heavy throne groaned under the sheer weight of his excess, a man whose stomach grew vast while Israel's collective spirit shrank to nothing. Until, yet again, the people remembered. Yet again they cried out. And yet again mercy answered. This time, God raised up a man named Ehud, from the tribe of Benjamin. His name meant, son of the right hand. Crucially, however, Ehud himself was left-handed. That detail mattered immensely, because the enemy would never anticipate what was about to happen. Ehud meticulously crafted a short sword, a dagger perfectly sized for concealment. He strapped it to his right thigh, underneath his flowing robes, a location no soldier would ever think to check, as this was the spot where a right-handed man would never carry a weapon. He then joined a delegation sent to deliver tribute to King Eglon, coins, goods, and offerings of forced loyalty. They bowed low, presented the treasure, and Ehud turned to depart. But just outside the palace gates, he paused, turned back, and whispered to the guards, "I have a secret, sacred message for the king." Eglon, arrogant and unaware in his curiosity, instantly dismissed his retinue. Now it was just Ehud and the monstrously large king, alone in the cool, silent upper chamber. Ehud leaned close. "I have a message from God for you," he stated softly, and as Eglon laboriously stood, his wide frame rising from the throne, Ehud reached, not to his expected left side, but quickly to the hidden dagger on his right thigh. He drove the blade deep with all his force into Eglon's vast belly. It was plunged so deep that the great folds of fat instantly closed over the weapon, swallowing the handle whole. Eglon collapsed, dead. Ehud calmly locked the doors behind him and walked out through the portico. Later, the guards returned. The doors were locked. They waited, assuming the king was relieving himself. They laughed, they whispered, they delayed, until finally, their patience evaporated. They opened the door and found their king lifeless on the floor, the hidden weapon still embedded in his flesh. Too late. Ehud had long since escaped. He made his way to the mountains of Ephraim, and there he blew a trumpet. The sound echoed like thunder down the hillsides. The people gathered, their fear instantly transforming into fighting fire, their shame morphing into courage. Ehud raised his voice and shouted, "Follow me, for the Lord has delivered Moab, your enemy, into our hands." And they charged. They struck down 10,000 Moabite soldiers, strong, seasoned, ruthless men. Not one was permitted to escape. That day, Moab was utterly defeated, and once again, the land of Israel had peace. This time, the peace lasted for 80 astonishing years. 80 years of peace. That is a long time to forget. But forget they did. The Israelites eventually turned away from their God, and he delivered them into the cruel hands of Jabin, the king of Canaan. Jabin ruled from Hazor, a massively fortified northern city. His general, Sisera, commanded 900 iron chariots. These were not merely machines of war. They were psychological symbols of crushing, inevitable dominance. Every time Israel attempted to rise, those chariots rolled in, destroying hope, burning fields, and scattering courage. For 20 long years, Sisera pressed upon God's people. 20 years of pervasive fear, 20 years of silence, until the desperate cries began again. This time, God did not raise a warrior. He raised a woman. Her name was Deborah. She was a prophetess, a judge, a clear voice of God speaking truth in a time of deafening noise. She did not preside in a grand palace. She sat beneath a solitary palm tree, positioned strategically between Ramah and Bethel, an open-air courtroom where people brought their complex disputes and left with divinely inspired wisdom. She was universally respected, deeply trusted, and utterly fearless. One day, she summoned a man named Barak, a capable warrior, strong in body, yet timid in spirit. Deborah looked him directly in the eye. "God commands you," she stated. "Take 10,000 men from the tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun. Go to Mount Tabor. There, Sisera will come to meet you, and the Lord himself will deliver him into your hands." Barak did not refuse outright, but neither did he accept without condition. Instead, he said, "I will only go if you, Deborah, come with me." Deborah did not flinch. "I will certainly go with you," she replied, her voice firm. "But because you asked for this condition, the ultimate honor of the victory will not be yours. The Lord will hand Sisera over to a woman." And so the two marched. Mount Tabor stood tall and lonely, a sentinel rising above the Jezreel Valley. Barak's 10,000 infantrymen climbed its slopes. From the valley floor below, Sisera's dreaded chariots thundered forward, iron wheels glinting malevolently in the sun. Then, Deborah gave the signal, "Advance! This is the precise day the Lord delivers Sisera into your hands. The Lord himself is going before you." Barak and his army charged down the mountain. But they were not alone. Something unseen moved with them. God sent a sudden, torrential storm. Rain hammered down from the sky. The earth instantly turned to thick, swallowing mud that choked the wheels of Sisera's iron chariots. His armored machines of war became useless, bogged down wreckage. Confusion erupted among his professional troops, and they were utterly destroyed. Every single one fell, save for Sisera himself. He fled on foot, sprinting desperately through the fields, past the scattered trees, his heart hammering in utter panic. He ran until he spotted a tent. It belonged to Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Her people maintained a shaky neutrality with King Jabin, or so Sisera foolishly believed. Jael stepped out. Her voice was soothing and kind. Her eyes were calm and calculating. "Come in, my lord," she welcomed him. "Do not be afraid." He stumbled into the tent. She covered him with a heavy blanket. "I am desperately thirsty," he whispered. She gave him milk, rich and cold. He relaxed, his eyes already closing. "Stand at the door," he muttered drowsily. "If anyone comes, tell them I am not here." And the mighty general, the master of the Iron Chariot, the terror of Israel, fell asleep. Jael moved silently. She took a sharp tent peg in one hand and a heavy workman's hammer in the other. She knelt beside the sleeping man, raised her arm, and drove the wooden spike through his temple, pinning him to the earth beneath the tent floor. He never woke. When Barak finally arrived, breathless and searching for his fleeing quarry, Jael stepped out with a serene confidence. "Come," she invited him. "I will show you the man you are looking for." And there he lay dead. The enemy was vanquished by two women, one armed with divine wisdom, the other with terrifying, domestic boldness. That day, God granted Israel a decisive victory over Jabin, king of Canaan. Slowly, his stranglehold on the land withered until he was no more. Not every great victory concludes with a triumphant battle cry. Some conclude with a song. After Sisera fell, after Jael's tent peg silenced Canaan's greatest threat, and after peace tentatively returned, Deborah did not simply move on. She sang. With Barak standing stiffly at her side, she lifted her voice, not to glorify herself or her warriors, but to glorify the omnipotent Lord. And what a song it was. A song of memory. A song of warning. A song of worship. "When the princes of Israel take the lead," she sang. "When the people willingly offered themselves, praise the Lord." Deborah recalled the recent past, the paralyzing fear. She remembered how the roads were empty, how travelers avoided the great highways, how village life had virtually ceased throughout Israel. "Until I, Deborah, arose. Arose a mother in Israel. Not a general, not a queen, but a mother. Because what she fought for was not territory or glory, but the future, safety, and faithfulness of her children." She noted the depth of the humiliation. Not a shield or spear could be found among 40,000 in Israel. That's how low their national morale and preparedness had sunk. No weapons, no confidence, only fear and hiding. But some stood up. Deborah praised them by name. From Ephraim came the root of Amalek. Benjamin followed. From Machir marched the commanders. From Zebulun came those who bravely carried the officer's staff. She honored the tribes that committed fully and called out those who failed. Why did Reuben stay among the sheep pens? Gilead stayed across the Jordan. Dan lingered shamefully with his ships. Asher remained by the coast. In the face of mortal danger, they chose comfort and commerce. Yet others rose to the occasion. "The people of Zebulun risked their very lives," she declared. "As did Naphtali upon the high places of the field." Then, she turned her eyes to the heavens. From the heavens the stars fought. From their courses they fought against Sisera. Even the natural creation had joined the battle. The Kishon River swelled into a divine flood. Chariots were drowned. Panic spread. And Jael. Deborah reserved her highest, most terrible praise for the woman with the tent peg. "Most blessed of women be Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Most blessed of tent-dwelling women." He asked for water, but she brought him milk. She brought him curds in a noble's bowl. She stretched her hand for the tent peg, her right hand for the heavy hammer, and she struck Sisera. At her feet he sank, he fell, he lay still. Where he sank, there he fell, dead. But even in this magnificent triumph, Deborah did not neglect the human pain of war. She imagined Sisera's mother, peering through her window, crying out, "Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why are the hoofbeats of his horses delayed?" The mother waited, but he would never return. And finally, Deborah sang the ending that echoes into eternity. "So may all your enemies perish, O Lord, but may all those who sincerely love you be like the sun when it rises in its full, blinding strength." And then the land had peace for 40 more years. Not because of a powerful monarchy, and not because of a standing army, but because of one woman who listened to the voice of God and another who acted with courage and deadly conviction. The land had peace until it didn't. 40 years passed after Deborah's song, and once again, Israel forgot. They committed evil. They turned from God, and the Lord delivered them over once more. this time to the Midianites. And the Midianites were not merely conquerors. They were true devourers. Every year, at the precise time of harvest, they came like an unstoppable plague of desert locusts. Riders on camels, thieves in waves, they were a devastating tide. They didn't just assault fortified cities. They swept through the entire arable land, a terrifying, unchecked plague. They stole the ripening crops, ruthlessly slaughtered the sheep for their own feast, seized every donkey, and left utter desolation in their wake. Nothing remained but empty, dust-choked fields, trees stripped bare, and the starving people driven to hide in the deep, dark recesses of caves and crevices high on the mountain cliffs. For 7 agonizing years, this crushing oppression continued. 7 years of watching the enemy grow rich and fat on the very fruits of their desperate labor. 7 years marked by a profound, agonizing silence from heaven. A silence that felt like abandonment. 7 years defined by the gnawing, pervasive fear that ate away at their souls. Until, finally, the people cried out once more, their voices raw with penitence and despair. And God answered, but the deliverance came in a manner entirely unexpected. Not with the thunder of a grand army, not through the proclamation of a magnificent king, but with a quiet, private whisper directed toward a profoundly ordinary man named Gideon. He was not leading warriors. He was not standing tall on a battlefield. He was deep inside a wine press, secretly threshing the few kernels of wheat he had managed to hide, desperately trying to keep a sliver of life intact. That is precisely where the angel of the Lord materialized. Right there, amidst the fear, the flying dust, and the deep shadows of his shame. The angel's gaze fixed upon Gideon, and he spoke the astonishing words, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." "Mighty warrior?" Gideon looked frantically around the small stone press. "Me?" he responded, his voice laced with bitterness and disbelief. "If the Lord is truly with us," he challenged, "then why has this unspeakable disaster befallen us? Where are the stupendous miracles our fathers constantly told us about? Did not God bring us out of Egypt with a strong hand? But now, it seems, the Lord has utterly abandoned us and delivered us into the grasp of Midian." The angel did not engage in debate. He offered no arguments or theological explanations. He issued a clear command, sharp and uncompromising. "Go in the strength you possess right now. I am sending you forth to rescue Israel from the hand of Midian." But Gideon was far from convinced. He felt the weight of his own insignificance. "My clan is the weakest in all of Manasseh," he lamented. "And I am the most inconsequential, the least important person in my entire family." Yet the divine voice stood firm. "I will certainly be with you," the voice promised. "And because of this, you will strike down the vast hordes of the Midianites as easily as if they were merely one solitary man." Still, Gideon required tangible proof, a sign he could grasp. So he painstakingly prepared a feast, tender meat and unleavened bread, and placed it reverently upon a flat rock. The angel merely extended his staff and touched the offering. Instantly, fire flared up from the cold stone itself, a searing inferno that consumed the food in a flash of heat. Then, just as suddenly, the angel vanished. Overwhelmed, Gideon fell utterly to the ground. "Alas, O Lord God," he cried out in terror, "for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." But God spoke again, a voice of comforting assurance. "Peace be with you. Do not be afraid. You shall not die." In that moment of profound realization, Gideon built an altar there and named it Jehovah Shalom, meaning "The Lord is peace." That very night, God gave Gideon his first, immediate mission, a test of obedience before the war began. "Tear down the stone altar of Baal that belongs to your father. Cut down the sacred Asherah pole standing beside it. Then, construct a proper altar to me upon this high ground and offer a sacrifice using the wood from the pagan pole." Gideon obeyed, but he executed the deed under the impenetrable cover of darkness, because even the dawn of great bravery often begins in small, fearful steps. The next morning, the town woke to a shocking sight. Baal's revered altar was smashed to fragments, the Asherah pole reduced to kindling, and a new, unfamiliar altar stood defiantly in its place. The people were instantly furious. "Who committed this sacrilege?" they roared. They quickly discovered the culprit. "Bring Gideon out," they screamed. "He must surely die for this." But then, Gideon's own father, Josh, the very man who had built that altar to Baal, found a sudden, unexpected voice of reason. "Let Baal defend himself," he challenged the angry crowd. "If he is truly a god, he needs no human defense. Let him contend." And faced with that irrefutable logic, the mob backed down. From that pivotal day, Gideon was known by the name Jerubbaal, meaning "let Baal contend." But this initial act of spiritual reform was merely the prelude. Soon, the immense valley of Jezreel began to fill with enemy armies, Midianites, Amalekites, and countless others, a number too vast and intimidating to count. And the powerful spirit of the Lord enveloped Gideon. He seized a trumpet, sounded the call, and summoned the tribes, and they rallied to him. Yet, Gideon's deep-seated uncertainty persisted. He sought yet another sign. "If you truly intend to save Israel by my hand," he prayed, "let this fleece I place on the threshing floor be completely drenched with dew, while the ground all around it remains perfectly dry." The next morning it was so. He wrung a bowl full of water from the fleece. Still doubting, he asked God again, reversing the conditions. "This time, let the fleece itself be dry, but let the ground all around be saturated with dew." Again, God answered his plea. The ground was soaked. The fleece was bone dry. Now, the fearful man hiding in the winepress was finally ready. Not because he had suddenly become inherently brave, but because he had received undeniable confirmation of a power far greater than his own. The valley below them was a churning sea of enemies. Midianites, Amalekites, and nomadic hordes from the east. Their camels covered the land as densely as sand on the seashore. Gideon stood above it all, still trembling, yet leading. Thousands of Israelites had answered his call. 32,000 men stood arrayed behind him. But God had a different, surprising plan. "You have far too many men," the Lord declared. "If you prevail with this immense army, Israel will surely boast. We achieved this victory by our own strength. I will not permit that to happen." So God gave Gideon a crucial test. "Announce to the people, anyone who is faint-hearted or afraid, go home now." And 22,000 men immediately abandoned the cause. Just like that, now only 10,000 remained. "Still too many," God stated. "Lead them down to the water," he commanded. "I will test them for you there." Gideon watched intently. Some men dropped heavily to their knees and drank, their faces submerged carelessly in the stream. Others, however, remained alert. They scooped the water into their hands and lapped it quickly, like attentive hunting dogs constantly scanning their surroundings. God said, "Set apart only the ones who drank from their hands." That group consisted of precisely 300 men. 300 men against an army whose numbers defied calculation. God smiled upon them. "With these 300, he promised, I will deliver Israel." The remaining men were sent home. That night, Gideon still wrestled privately with residual fear. So, God offered him a gift of comfort. "If you are still afraid, take your servant Purah, go down into the enemy camp, and simply listen to what they are saying." Gideon and Purah crept down, past the thousands of tents, past the resting camels, until they overheard two ordinary soldiers talking. One shared a disturbing dream. "I saw a miserable round loaf of common barley bread tumble into our camp," he recounted. "It rolled right up to a tent and struck it so forcefully that the tent collapsed and lay utterly flat." The other soldier's face went pale with dread. "This can mean only one thing," he whispered. "That is the sword of Gideon, son of Josh. God has surely handed the entire Midianite camp into his grasp." Gideon's heart soared, instantly overcoming his fear. He did not immediately run back. He fell to his knees and worshipped right there, on enemy soil, whispering fervent thanks to the God who had orchestrated this divine reassurance. Then, He returned to his tiny force and revealed a plan that no conventional general would ever dare suggest. Take a trumpet. Take a clay jar. Hide a bright torch inside the jar. Follow my every move. 3 companies of 100 men each. No swords were drawn. No surprise attack relying on physical combat. Only sound, fire, and absolute faith. In the dead center of the middle watch of the night, they quietly surrounded the vast, sleeping camp. Gideon gave the crucial signal. Now! Simultaneously, they blew the piercing trumpets. They shattered the fragile jars with a deafening crash. They raised the blazing torches high into the night air. And together, their 300 voices shouted the terrifying battle cry. A sword for the Lord and for Gideon! The valley erupted into instantaneous, blinding chaos. The enemy woke in pure terror, seeing flames flickering everywhere and hearing the thunderous noise of 1,000 trumpets where there were only 300. In their panic, they mistook their own comrades for the advancing Israelite army. They turned on each other, striking wildly, their swords stained with their own blood. Screams echoed across the night sky. Horses fled in disarray. Camels scattered. Soldiers ran blindly through the hills in every direction. Israel had no weapons in hand, but the enemy was already utterly defeated by panic. Those Midianites who managed to escape were pursued relentlessly. Men from the tribes of Naphtali, Asher, and Ephraim joined the chase. 2 key enemy princes, Oreb and Zeb, were captured and killed at locations that would forever bear their names. And as the dust settled on the morning of victory, Gideon's 300 stood tall. Not because of their physical might, and certainly not because of conventional strategy, but because they had trusted a God who wins battles with broken clay jars and a flicker of courage. They had obeyed when the command made no human sense. They understood that sometimes, faith is not about raising a bigger army, but about believing a divine whisper in the darkness more than the intimidating sight your eyes see in the light. The battlefield was quiet now. The camels were gone, the tents torn down. The valley that had recently echoed with hooves and shouts now lay utterly still. Gideon's name was on every tongue. People whispered it like a legend, sang it like a triumphant psalm. The man who tore down idols. The man who fought with 300 men. The man who watched God shatter a colossal army. But the war was not entirely over. 2 Midianite kings, Zeba and Zalmunna, had escaped with the remnants of their force. And Gideon was far from done. With his weary, but determined 300 men, he gave chase across the River Jordan. Exhausted, desperately hungry, and driven by righteous vengeance, they arrived at a town called Succoth. Gideon approached the elders. "Please give my men bread," he pleaded. "They are worn out, but we are still pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna." But the leaders sneered contemptuously. "Do you already hold those kings in your hands?" They mocked. "Why should we risk our own safety by feeding your ragged band?" Gideon's face hardened, his voice low with menace. "When the Lord delivers those kings into my power," he vowed, "I will return here, and I will punish every one of you with sharp thorns and briars from the desert." He pressed on to the next town, Penuel. Same request, same immediate, scornful rejection. "When I return," he warned them grimly, "I will tear down your fortified tower." And still he pressed on, across the harsh wilderness, over the challenging hills, until he finally found the 2 kings. Midian's remaining army, still traumatized and afraid, was caught entirely by surprise. Gideon captured them, Zeba and Zalmunna, the cruel kings, the merciless killers of his people. He turned back toward home. He returned to Succoth, bringing irrefutable proof. "Here they are," he announced, displaying the chained kings. "The men you mocked me for chasing." Then, he took the elders of the town and gave them a brutal lesson they would never forget. He lashed them severely with desert thorns. He then moved on and tore down the tower in Penuel, justice harsh and swift. Finally, he turned to the kings. "What were the men like?" he demanded. "The ones you killed at Tabor." The kings looked him directly in the eye, noting the regal bearing even of a simple Israelite judge. "They looked like you," they replied. "Like sons of a king." Gideon's voice cracked with raw grief. They were my brothers, the sons of my mother. He choked out. If you had only spared them, I would spare you now. He turned to his young, terrified son. Kill them. But the boy was too frightened. So, Gideon stepped forward himself, and with a single stroke, he ended their lives, avenging the blood of his kin. The land was safe. The enemies were gone. And then the people came, filled with gratitude and awe. Rule over us, they begged. You, your son, and your grandson, you have saved us. It was the pinnacle of his achievement. The crown, the ultimate power, was within easy reach. But Gideon said something that no ambitious warlord would ever utter. I will not rule over you. My son will not rule over you. The Lord alone will rule over you. He refused the throne. He walked away from the chance at dynasty. He made one simple request. Each of you, give me one gold earring from your share of the plunder. And they did. The gold piled high, weighing over 40 pounds. From this wealth, Gideon fashioned an ephod, a sacred, elaborate vestment like that worn by the priests. He placed it in his hometown of Ophrah. It was intended to honor God. But tragically, it quickly morphed into something else entirely. People flocked to Ophrah to worship the golden object. They bowed before it, and it became a snare, not just for the people, but for Gideon and his family, a silent compromise that undermined his great refusal of kingship. Gideon was fruitful. He had many wives, 70 sons, and even a son from a concubine in Shechem named Abimelech. He lived out the rest of his days in peace. The Midianites never rose up again during his lifetime. Gideon, also known as Jerubbaal, died old and honored. But immediately after his death, the fickle people turned away again. They chased after the Baals. They forgot the Lord who saved them. They forgot Gideon. They forgot everything. Because sometimes, the final test isn't about the enemy you fight on the outside. It's about the silent idolatry you carry inside. After Gideon's death, the land entered a period of relative quiet. But peace, when unguarded, quickly becomes fragile. Abimelech, Gideon's ambitious son by the Shechemite concubine, harbored a dark ambition. Not content to be merely one son among 70, he sought to be the one man above all. He approached his mother's powerful relatives in Shechem with a cunning proposition. Would you truly prefer to be ruled by 70 unpredictable sons of Gideon, or by one single man, your own flesh and blood? The people of Shechem, swayed by the lure of kinship and the promise of influence, chose Abimelech. They gave him 70 silver shekels from the temple of Baal-berith. With this blood money, Abimelech hired reckless, desperate men, mercenaries without conscience. He marched to Ophrah, his father's town, and on one single fateful stone, he ruthlessly murdered all 70 of his brothers. Only Jotham, the youngest son, managed to escape the slaughter by hiding. Abimelech was then crowned king beside the great tree at the pillar in Shechem. But Jotham, observing from the secure heights of Mount Gerizim, cried out a powerful, chilling parable to the people below. The trees sought a king. They asked the useful olive tree, the sweet fig tree, and the fruitful vine, but all graciously declined the distraction of ruling. Then, they asked the worthless thorn bush, which immediately accepted warning. Take refuge beneath my meager shade, or else fire will surely come forth from the thorn bush and consume the cedars of Lebanon. Jotham concluded with a stark warning. If you have acted honorably today, may you rejoice in Abimelech. But if not, may fire come from Abimelech to consume you, and fire from you to consume him. Then Jotham fled for his life. Abimelech ruled Israel for 3 turbulent years. But God was watching. He sent an evil spirit of discord between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem, setting them against one another. Gaal, son of Ebed, moved into Shechem and openly challenged Abimelech's authority. Zebul, the city's governor and Abimelech's ally, sent urgent word to Abimelech. Abimelech immediately set an ambush. As Gaal stood brazenly at the city gate, Abimelech's men attacked, driving Gaal out of the city. The next day, when the people went into the fields, Abimelech divided his forces into 3 companies and attacked again. He captured the city, massacred its inhabitants, and, as a final act of utter scorn, sowed it with salt to ensure nothing would ever grow there again. The remaining leaders of Shechem took refuge in the Tower of El-Berith. Abimelech gathered wood, piled it high against the tower, and set it ablaze, killing about 1,000 men and women inside. Then, Abimelech went to the town of Thebes. The people there fled into a strong stone tower. As Abimelech approached the base, intending to burn it down as he had Shechem, a woman dropped a heavy upper millstone from the roof directly onto his head, cracking his skull. Mortally wounded, he immediately called out to his armor-bearer, "Quickly, draw your sword and kill me. Make sure they cannot say that a woman killed me." So his servant ran him through and Abimelech died. Thus, God repaid Abimelech for the heinous evil he had done to his own father's house by murdering his 70 brothers. God also made the people of Shechem pay for their wickedness in aiding the atrocity. After the fires of Abimelech's cruel reign finally died out, and after the blood dried in Shechem's streets, Israel desperately needed healing. Not another warrior king, not another man of spectacular vengeance, but simply a steady leader who could restore some measure of peace and judicial order. That man was Tola, from the tribe of Issachar. He lived in the hill country of Ephraim in a town called Shamir. He was not flashy. He conquered no nations, nor did he tear down idols with fire. He judged Israel for 23 years. He led quietly with justice with steadiness. Sometimes, God does not bring lasting change with a trumpet blast, but with a quiet whisper that holds firm. When Tola died, he was buried in Shamir. And then came Jair the Gileadite. His name literally meant "he shines." He was a man of distinction, evidenced by his 30 sons, each of whom rode on his own donkey, each one ruling over a town in Gilead. 30 sons, 30 towns. They called the region Havoth Jair, which means villages of Jair. Jair judged Israel for 22 years. He, too, was not known for grand, dramatic battles, but he stood in the widening gap. He led when others forgot how. He simply held Israel together just long enough. Then Jair died, and they buried him in Canaan. These two men, Tola and Jair, they were unlike the fiery Gideon or the ferocious Deborah or the powerful Samson. But they were God's chosen stabilizers. Sometimes the mightiest leaders are the ones who simply remain faithful and consistent when everyone else descends into chaos and forgets their covenant. In the rugged lands of Gilead lived a man named Jephthah. He was strong, skilled, and respected for his raw bravery, but he was also an outcast. Why? Because Jephthah was the son of a prostitute. His father, Gilead, had other legitimate sons with his wife, and when they grew up, they ruthlessly pushed Jephthah out. "You will have no share in our inheritance," they declared, their faces full of scorn. "You are not really one of us." So Jephthah fled. He settled in a desolate region called Tob. And there, something unexpected happened. Other outcasts gravitated toward him. Men with no homes, no names, rough, hardened fighters. And Jephthah became their leader. He was cast away, yet he became a formidable commander. He was shamed, but he became someone you absolutely did not want to cross. Years passed, and then the Ammonites launched a full-scale invasion of Israel. Their army moved like a dark thunderstorm, gathering menacingly on the borders. Suddenly, the elders and leaders of Gilead frantically remembered Jephthah. They went to him in Tob. "Come, lead our army," they pleaded. "Fight for us." Jephthah looked them coldly in the eye. "Didn't you hate me?" he shot back. "Didn't you viciously drive me out of my father's house? Why do you want me back now that you are in deep trouble?" they pleaded, truly desperate. "We need you, and if you come, we will make you head and commander over all the people of Gilead." Jephthah agreed, but made them swear a binding oath before the Lord in Mizpah. And they did. So Jephthah returned. The outcast came home as commander, as judge. But before lifting his sword, Jephthah attempted diplomacy. He sent messengers to the king of Ammon. "Why are you launching this unprovoked attack against us?" The king answered with a claim of ancient rights. "Israel took our land when they came up from Egypt. Give it back now. But Jephthah sent a reply full of historical knowledge and undeniable truth. We asked only to pass peacefully through the land. The other nations blocked us. We did not take your land. God gave it to us after defeating the Amorites. You've had 300 years to claim it. Now you want it back? I have not wronged you. You are the one picking this fight. The king ignored the history lesson. So, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon Jephthah. He marched through Gilead, through Manasseh, to the border of the Ammonites. But before the battle commenced, Jephthah made a dangerous, terrible vow. Lord, if you grant me absolute victory over the Ammonites, I will offer as a sacrifice whatever first comes out of my house to greet me upon my victorious return. He fought. He conquered. 20 towns were taken. The Ammonites were crushed and subdued. Israel was safe. But when Jephthah returned home, the first to run out to greet him was his daughter, his only child. She came out dancing, joyously celebrating his return, utterly unaware of the tragic price she would pay. Jephthah instantly collapsed, tearing his clothes in anguish. "Oh, my daughter, you have utterly broken my heart," he cried. "I made a solemn vow to the Lord, and I cannot take it back." She did not cry. She did not beg for her life. She demonstrated a courage that surpassed her father's grief. "If you made a promise to the Lord, father," she said, "keep it. But please give me 2 months to go into the hills with my companions and mourn the life I will never have, the life of motherhood and marriage." He let her go. And when she returned, he kept his vow. A monumental victory wrapped in profound, eternal heartbreak. From then on, every year, the young women of Israel would gather to remember her sacrifice. They would go to the hills and honor her courageous spirit. The man they threw away became the man they needed most. But his story remains a stark reminder that words spoken in haste, even in the fervor of faith, can cost everything. The victory over the Ammonites should have brought lasting peace. But pride always has a final, destructive word. After the battle, the tribe of Ephraim, one of Israel's strongest, came storming in. They were furious. They confronted Jephthah, shouting, "Why did you not summon us to fight the Ammonites with you? We are going to burn your house down over your head." Jephthah stood firm, no anger in his voice, only the cutting edge of truth. "I did call you," he declared. "You refused to come, so I took my life in my hands. I fought without you, and the Lord gave me victory. Why do you come at me now after the fight is done?" But the Ephraimites were driven by wounded pride. They didn't care about the truth. They didn't like being left out or outshined. And worst of all, they hurled venomous insults at Jephthah's people, the Gileadites. "You are nothing but runaways from Ephraim," they sneered. "You don't belong to a real tribe." Insults quickly escalated into deadly threats. Words curdled into civil war. Jephthah had no choice. He called his warriors. A bloody battle broke out between brothers. The Gileadites soundly defeated Ephraim's forces. Then they blocked the Jordan River, the vital escape route home. Every Ephraimite trying to cross was stopped and subjected to a loyalty test. Say the word Shibboleth. But the Ephraimites, due to a dialectical difference, could not pronounce the SH sound correctly. They would say Sibboleth, a small, linguistic difference. That small difference meant everything. It instantly revealed who was friend and who was foe. And on that riverbank, 42,000 Ephraimites were killed by their own kin. Not Canaanites, not Philistines, their own people. It was one of the darkest, most tragic days in Israel's history, when jealousy mattered more than unity, when pride mattered more than truth, when brothers became enemies over mere words and wounds that never healed. After that terrible episode, Jephthah judged Israel for 6 more years and then he died. The man who once stood against outsiders ultimately had to stand against his own. Not every chapter of history is loud. Not every leader carries a sword. Some simply hold the nation steady when the ground beneath it violently shakes. After Jephthah's time, Israel was in a fragile place, the people weary from both foreign and civil war. What they desperately needed was stability, and God provided it through a succession of quiet men. First came Ibzan of Bethlehem. He judged Israel for 7 years. We know of no great military victories under his name, but we know this, he had 30 sons and 30 daughters. He strategically gave his daughters in marriage outside his immediate clan and brought wives from beyond for his sons. Why does this matter? Because it demonstrates foresight and wisdom. Ibsen wasn't building an army. He was building peace, forming alliances, keeping Israel united one interconnected household at a time. When he died, they buried him in Bethlehem. Then came Elon from the tribe of Zebulun. He judged Israel for 10 years, a quiet leader from a quiet tribe. No battles, no monuments, just 10 years of calm. Sometimes, peace is the greatest victory of all. After Elon came Abdon, son of Hillel, from the town of Pirathon. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons, and they rode on 70 donkeys, a significant symbol of wealth and nobility in ancient times. Abdon judged Israel for 8 years. His leadership, like the donkeys his family rode, was steady, practical, and deeply rooted. He wasn't flashy, but he preserved the peace. And sometimes, keeping the peace in a nation always on the edge of rebellion is the hardest job of all. When Abdon died, he was buried in Pirathon. Three judges, three quiet chapters. No thrones, no thunderous swords, just men who diligently filled the fragile space between chaos and order, maintaining stability long enough for the next, dramatic hero to rise. Inevitably, Israel sinned again. And again, God handed them over, this time to the oppressive power of the Philistines. For 40 agonizing years they ruled over Israel, oppressing, humiliating, and growing bolder every day. But God had a plan, one that bypassed armies and kings yet again. He chose to work through a baby. In the hill country of the tribe of Dan, there lived a man named Manoah. His wife was barren and could not bear children, until one day, an angel of the Lord appeared to her. "You are going to conceive and bear a son," the angel declared. "He must be set apart from birth as a Nazirite. No wine, no unclean food, and no razor must ever touch his head. He is the one who will begin the long, slow work of saving Israel from the crushing hand of the Philistines." The woman ran immediately to tell her husband the miraculous news. And Manoah, humbled and awestruck, prayed for guidance. "Lord, let this man return to us and instruct us in how we are to raise this child." The messenger of God answered that prayer and appeared once more, the divine presence radiating a solemn authority. Manoah, still overwhelmed by the encounter, attempted to honor their guest by offering a meal, but the angel corrected him, saying, "If you prepare an offering, offer it to the Lord alone." As the sacrifice was consumed, the flames leaped high, and in an astounding vision, the angel of the Lord ascended in the smoke and fire, disappearing back into the heavens. Manoah fell face down, paralyzed by terror. "We have seen God," he whispered, horrified. "We are certainly going to die." But his wife, ever the voice of steady wisdom, remained calm. "If the Lord had truly intended to kill us," she countered, "he would not have accepted our burnt offering, nor would he have revealed all these things to us." Later, she gave birth to the promised son. They named him Samson, which means sun-like or little Sunday, and from his earliest days, the Spirit of the Lord began to stir within him, granting him preternatural power. He was set apart as a Nazirite from the womb, chosen, consecrated, and anointed for a specific holy purpose. Yet, the story of Samson would forever be a study in tragic contradiction. His miraculous strength was constantly in tension with his profound moral weakness. His divine calling was perpetually at war with his earthly, reckless desires. That internal war was only just beginning. Samson grew into a fearsome man, strong not just in muscle and stature, but perhaps too strong in his own towering confidence. One day, fueled by this self-assurance, he journeyed down to Timnah, a Philistine city, the very heart of the enemy territory. And there, amidst the forbidden landscape, he saw her. A Philistine woman, stunningly beautiful, undeniably captivating, and utterly off-limits according to the law of his people. He rushed home and issued a command to his horrified parents. "I saw a woman in Timnah. She is the one. Go down and get her for me to be my wife." His parents were utterly stunned. "Can't you find a suitable bride among the daughters of our own people?" they pleaded, instead of seeking a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines. But Samson was firm, insisting, "She is the one who pleases me." They did not understand that this impulsive, reckless choice, this consuming desire for a foreign woman, was unknowingly part of God's larger, strategic plan to provoke and confront the Philistines. Reluctantly, they went to Timnah to arrange the marriage. On the journey, Samson walked ahead, navigating the dusty paths through a sprawling vineyard. Suddenly, with a deafening roar, a powerful young lion leaped out, blocking his path. In a terrifying flash, the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon Samson with explosive force. With nothing but his bare hands, he seized the roaring beast and ripped it apart as easily as tearing a young goat limb from limb. He left the carcass lying there and proceeded without mentioning the unbelievable feat to his parents. Days later, passing the same spot on a subsequent trip, he curiously turned aside to see the lion's remains. Inside the dried carcass, a colony of bees had settled and produced a store of rich, dark honey. Samson scooped some out with his hand. He ate it and gave some to his parents, carefully concealing the gruesome source. The wedding feast was held, a week-long celebration that was customary. During the festivities, Samson found himself surrounded by 30 Philistine men and issued a confident challenge. A wager. "Allow me to pose a riddle," he declared. "If you solve it within the 7 days of the feast, I will give you 30 complete suits of fine clothing. If you cannot, then you must give me 30 sets of clothing." They readily agreed, and he delivered the cryptic verse. "Out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet." The men puzzled over it ceaselessly. They debated, argued, and wrestled with the riddle, but they could not unlock its secret. Frustrated and unwilling to admit defeat, they resorted to cruel coercion. They went straight to Samson's new wife and delivered a chilling threat. "Trick your husband into telling you the answer, or we will burn you and your father's entire house down." Day after relentless day, she subjected Samson to a relentless assault of weeping, begging, and nagging. Finally, weary unto death by her insistent pleas, he gave in and revealed the truth of the honey and the lion. She immediately ran to the Philistines, who came back to Samson on the 7th day before sunset with the answer, "What is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion?" Samson's eyes narrowed, his anger a cold, hard knot. He knew instantly how they had obtained the solution. "If you had not plowed with my heifer," he retorted bitterly, "you would never have solved my riddle." Immediately, the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him once more. Driven by rage and the need to fulfill his end of the terrible bargain, he stormed down to the Philistine city of Ashkelon, where he single-handedly struck down 30 men, stripped them of their fine garments, and gave the clothes to the cheating wedding guests. He then departed, consumed by fury, humiliated, and deeply betrayed. His new wife, in turn, was promptly given by her family to his best man, the friend who had served as his wedding attendant. This wasn't just heartbreak. It was the catastrophic spark that ignited the true war between Samson and the Philistines. Some wounds, he would soon learn, cut deeper than any blade. When Samson returned to Timnah, his heart still bruised and his anger still simmering, he attempted a reconciliation, bringing a young goat as a traditional peace offering. "I want to go in and see my wife," he announced. But her father blocked his way. "I truly thought you hated her," the father explained. "That is why I gave her to your best man. But look, her younger sister is prettier than she is. You can marry her instead." Samson's jaw clenched tight. The pain of the previous betrayal instantly ignited into consuming fury. This time he roared, "I cannot be blamed for what I do to the Philistines," and with that terrifying threat, he vanished into the wilderness hills. What he did next, no one could have anticipated. Samson set out and caught 300 wild foxes. He tied them together in pairs, tail to tail, and between the tails of each pair, he fastened a flaming, oil-soaked torch. Then he released them simultaneously into the fully ripened grain fields of the Philistines. The flames raced across the landscape, engulfing the standing grain, the precious vineyards, and the ancient olive groves. It was an inferno of revenge, a total ecological and economic disaster. The Philistines were stunned into disbelief. "Who is responsible for this outrage?" they demanded. Someone whispered the name, "Samson." "Because they gave his wife away," the man explained. So the Philistines did what cruel men always do. They deflected the blame and sought the easiest targets. They blamed the woman and her family. In a vicious act of retribution, they burned her and her father alive. When Samson received the news of their barbaric retaliation, he didn't weep or run. He stood firm and delivered a final dreadful promise. "If that is what you have done, I swear I will not stop until I have had my vengeance on you." He struck again, fierce and relentless, slaughtering countless Philistines in a devastating campaign. Afterward, he disappeared, retreating to a secure cave hidden high in the rock of Etam. But the Philistines were far from finished. They mobilized a large force and invaded the territory of Judah, spreading fear among Samson's own people. The men of Judah, desperate to avoid a war they couldn't win, went up to the cave. "Why are you doing this to us?" they demanded of Samson. He simply replied, "I only did to them exactly what they did to me." The Judahites, ruled by fear and subjugation, begged him, "We have no choice. We must turn you over to the Philistines. They rule over us." Samson made them swear a solemn oath. "Swear to me that you yourselves will not kill me." So they bound him with two brand new ropes, strong and seemingly unbreakable, and escorted him down the hill toward the waiting Philistine army. As he drew near, the Philistines erupted in triumphant shouts of joy. But in that critical moment, the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him with breathtaking power, and the ropes that bound his arms disintegrated and fell away as easily as burned flax threads. He grabbed the closest makeshift weapon he could find, the fresh jawbone of a donkey, and with this crude implement he struck down 1,000 men. Breathless, standing alone over a sea of enemies slain by a bone, he declared in triumph, "With a donkey's jawbone, I piled them in heaps. With a donkey's jawbone, I killed 1,000 men." Then he dropped the grim weapon and named the place Ramoth-Lehi, meaning Jawbone Hill. Yet even legendary heroes are subject to human frailties. Parched and exhausted, Samson cried out to God, "Lord, you granted me this astonishing victory, and now I am going to die of simple thirst." In response, God split open a hollow place in the ground, and cool, fresh water miraculously gushed out. Samson drank deeply and was instantly revived. He named the spring En-Hakkor, the spring of the caller. From that moment forward, Samson assumed his role as the judge of Israel, holding authority for 20 turbulent years. He was a force of nature, a warrior, a rebel, a storm-given skin, but still a man chosen by God. Samson was the strongest man in Israel, yet his enduring weakness was not for battle, but for beauty. One day he traveled to Gaza, deep within hostile Philistine territory, where he spent the night with a prostitute. The Philistines heard the news and swiftly set a deadly trap. "At dawn, we strike," they whispered, sealing the massive city gates and surrounding the area. But Samson awoke at midnight. Instead of trying to sneak out quietly, he walked deliberately to the city gates, two towering doors of iron and stone. He reached out and, with unimaginable power, tore them completely from their hinges, locks and all. He hoisted the entire massive structure onto his shoulders and carried it a great distance to the top of a hill facing Hebron. He wasn't just escaping. He was sending an undeniable, terrifying message. "You cannot trap me." But even giants can fall, and for Samson, the agent of his downfall was a woman whose name was Delilah. She lived in the valley of Sorek, and once again, he gave in to his destructive desires. The Philistine rulers saw their final chance. They came to Delilah with a lucrative promise: find out the secret source of his phenomenal strength. "How can he be bound and subdued? We will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver." And Delilah smiled. She didn't need to fight him. She simply had to ask, "Samson, what makes you so strong? How could someone tie you up and finally make you weak?" Samson, arrogant and playful, toyed with her. "Tie me tightly with 7 fresh bowstrings that have never been dried," he suggested. I'll be as weak as any other man. That night, while he slept on her lap, she did exactly as he suggested. When the Philistines, hidden nearby, burst into the room, she cried out the warning. Samson, the Philistines are upon you. He instantly snapped the bowstrings like scorched, brittle threads. Delilah feigned hurt and pouted. You lied to me. Now tell me the real truth. He grinned. New ropes that have never been used. That would work. She tried again with the same result. Weave my 7 locks of hair into the warp of a loom, he next instructed. She did, securing it with a pin, yet he woke and broke free yet again. But Delilah was relentless. Day after day, she begged, pleaded, and cried, pressuring him until Samson was weary to the point of death. Finally, he surrendered his innermost secret, his heart, and his truth. I have been a Nazarite dedicated to God since I was born. If my hair is shaved off, I will lose my strength entirely and become like any ordinary man. She knew this time he was serious. She sent word immediately, come back. He has told me everything. That night, she lulled him to sleep on her lap. While he slept in the deep peace she had promised, she signaled a man to shave off the 7 braided locks of his hair. Then, she whispered the dreaded words. Samson, the Philistines are upon you. He woke up, ready to fight, thinking, I will break free like before. But he did not know it then. The Lord had abandoned him. They grabbed him instantly, overpowered him, gouged out his eyes, bound him tightly in heavy bronze chains, and threw him into the prison house of Gaza. The mighty judge of Israel was reduced to a blind slave, forced to grind grain like an animal in the dark silence. But in that silence, a slow, quiet miracle was taking place. His shorn hair began to grow back. Samson, once feared by entire armies, was now a pathetic trophy, blind, bound, and seemingly forgotten by his God. The Philistines could not contain their joy at having brought the mighty Samson low. They threw an immense, glorious feast in the temple of their god, Dagon. Thousands gathered, rulers, nobles, and common spectators, to drink and cheer. Then, someone shouted, "Bring out Samson, let him entertain us." So they brought him out, the man who once tore a lion apart, now stumbling, guided by the hand of a small servant boy. They mocked him, laughed at his misery, and paraded him through the surging crowd like a prize animal. Then, Samson whispered softly to the boy, "Please, lead me to the pillars that hold up the temple. I need to lean on them and rest." He was led to the 2 central columns, the essential supports holding the entire colossal structure. And there, in that place of utter humiliation and darkness, he prayed, not loud, not proud, but a prayer of desperate, final reality. "Lord God, remember me, I beg you. Strengthen me just this once. Oh God, let me take vengeance for my 2 eyes." And with both hands, he reached out, braced himself, and pushed with all his rekindled might. "Let me die with the Philistines." The massive stone pillars groaned under the strain. The ceiling cracked with a shattering sound, and the temple instantly collapsed. Stone, fire, and screams filled the air. Samson's final act was his most powerful. He killed more of his enemies in his death than he ever had during his life. Under the rubble, his enemies were gone. So was he. Later, his brothers came to the wreckage. They found his body and carried him away to bury him in the tomb of his father, Manoah. And the man they buried had judged Israel for 20 years. It is a story of incredible strength, a story of profound weakness, a story of failure, yet ultimately, a story of grace. Because even in his brokenness and destructive choices, God still used him. Sometimes, God's greatest victories are born from our lowest, darkest places. The narrative of chaos only deepens. In the rugged hill country of Ephraim lived a man named Micah. One day, he confessed to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver that were stolen from you, I have them. I took them." His mother, instead of punishing him, responded with a twisted piety, "Blessed be my son by the Lord." She then dedicated the silver, or at least a portion of it, to the Lord, instructing that it be used to make a carved wooden image and a metal idol. So Micah took the silver, and from it, an idol was fashioned. He immediately set up a private shrine in his house, made an ephod, a priestly garment, fashioned household gods, and consecrated one of his own sons to act as his personal priest. In those days, there was no central king or authority in Israel. Everyone simply did what was right in his own eyes. This was the era of moral anarchy. A young Levite from Bethlehem in Judah was traveling, seeking a stable place to settle and work. He came to Micah's house, and Micah, seeing an opportunity for religious legitimacy, said to him, "Stay with me. Be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver every year, a complete suit of clothes, and all your necessities." The Levite readily agreed to this mercenary arrangement. Micah consecrated him, and the young man became his exclusive priest. Micah rejoiced, certain in his self-made theology. "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, because I have a Levite as my priest." But this was not the true worship God had commanded. It was a man-made religion, a convenient blend of truth and idol worship, designed entirely for the worshipper's comfort. In those same chaotic days, the tribe of Dan was desperately seeking territory to settle, as they had failed to secure their allotted inheritance. They sent 5 men to explore the land. These men came upon Micah's house and, perhaps recognizing the liturgical accent, recognized the voice of the young Levite. They asked him, "Who brought you here? What are you doing in this isolated place?" He explained his comfortable arrangement with Micah. The men then asked for a spiritual consultation. "Please inquire of God for us to learn whether our journey will be successful." The priest, ever eager to please his paying clients, immediately replied, "Go in peace. The journey you are taking is under the Lord's eye." The men continued their travels and found the city of Laish, a quiet, peaceful community of people living unsuspecting and isolated lives. They returned to their tribe and reported back, "Let's attack them. The land is spacious and good, and God has surely given it into our hands." So 600 Danite warriors set out, heavily armed. When they reached Micah's house on their way north, the 5 scouts who had spied out the land suddenly declared, "Do you realize that in these houses nearby there is an ephod, household gods, a carved image, and a cast idol? Now you know exactly what to do." They quickly entered Micah's house and, without shame, stole the carved image, the ephod, the household gods, and the cast idol. The priest rushed out, utterly confused. "What are you doing?" he stammered. The Danites' answer was a blunt proposition. "Be quiet. Come with us. Be a father and a priest to us all. Isn't it far better to serve an entire tribe and clan in Israel as priest, rather than serving just one man's household?" The Levite was instantly won over. He was glad to accept the promotion. He took the ephod, the household gods, and the stolen carved image, and went along with the people. Micah soon discovered the theft. He gathered his neighbors and furiously pursued the Danites. When he caught up to them, he called out, "You took my gods that I made, and you took my priest, and then you simply went away. What do I have left?" The heavily armed Danites responded with a cold, clear threat, "Don't argue with us. If you provoke us further, some of our hot-tempered men will attack you, and you will surely lose your life." Micah saw that they were too strong for him and too numerous to fight. He turned back, defeated and stripped of his beloved religious possessions, and returned home. The Danites took what Micah had made, along with the turncoat priest, and marched to Laish. They attacked the unsuspecting city, put the people cruelly to the sword, and burned it to the ground. They rebuilt the city and settled there, naming it Dan. They immediately set up the stolen carved image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his descendants, served as priests for the tribe of Dan until the time of the captivity of the land. They continued to use the idol Micah had made all the time the true house of God was located in Shiloh. This stands as a painful story of stolen religion, of personal convenience replacing divine command, of a tribe choosing pragmatism over covenant, and of a nation sinking deeper into the chaos of doing what was right in their own eyes. The final descent into darkness concerns another Levite living in the remote hills of Ephraim. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah, but she became unfaithful and left him, returning to her father's house. After 4 long months, the Levite traveled to Bethlehem to speak kindly to her and convince her to return. Her father welcomed the Levite with open arms, urging him to stay longer and longer. They ate, they laughed, they delayed. But on the 5th day, the Levite finally insisted, "We must leave now." So they set out late in the evening. As darkness fell, they reached the city of Gibeah, in the territory of Benjamin, and needed a place to stay the night. Shockingly, no one in the town offered them hospitality, a severe breach of covenant law, until an old man came in from the fields. "Come with me," he urged them, ashamed of his community. "Don't spend the night exposed in the square." They went into his home, ate, and settled down to rest. But as true night enveloped the city, true evil arrived. Wicked men, the depraved residents of Gibeah, surrounded the house and began banging violently on the door. "Bring out the man who came into your house," they screamed. "We want to abuse him." The old man, horrified, begged them, "No, my brothers, don't do this wicked, disgraceful thing. This man is my guest." Then, in a moment of utter moral collapse, he offered them his own virgin daughter and the Levite's concubine instead. "Do whatever you wish to them," he pleaded, "but do not commit this outrage against the man." The evil men ignored his daughter, seized the concubine, dragged her out, and brutally abused her all night long. When the sun finally rose, the concubine collapsed at the door of the house, dying. When the Levite opened the door, he found her body lying there. "Get up," he said, "let's go." But there was no answer. She was gone. He carried her body back home. And then, in a state of shock, grief, and incandescent fury, he performed a deed so unthinkable that it remains one of the most horrific moments in the history of Israel. He took a knife and cut her body into 12 pieces. He sent a piece of her corpse to each of the 12 tribes of Israel. The message was unmistakable and searing. "Look what has been done in Israel. This is how far we have fallen." The tribes gathered as one. 400,000 soldiers stood before the Lord in Mizpah. They heard the Levites' terrible story, and they were enraged by the wickedness of Gibeah. They sent word to the tribe of Benjamin, "Hand over the men of Gibeah who committed this atrocity. Let us purge this evil from Israel." But the tribe of Benjamin stubbornly refused to surrender the criminals, choosing instead to protect their own wicked men. They prepared for war against their brothers. And so, brother stood against brother. Israel marched out and the civil war began. Day 1, Benjamin struck down 22,000 Israelites. Day 2, 18,000 more fell. But on the 3rd day, Israel set a decisive trap. They burned the city of Gibeah and surrounded the remaining Benjaminite warriors. 25,000 Benjamites were slaughtered that day. Only 600 men survived, managing to hide themselves in the desolate wilderness. Then, the rest of Israel turned on the towns of Benjamin, burning, killing, and erasing nearly every trace of the tribe in a bloody frenzy. After the bloodshed subsided, a profound sorrow settled upon the tribes. They gathered and wept before the Lord. One tribe, they mourned, is nearly gone from Israel. What have we done? They were reminded of a rash vow they had made. No daughter of ours will ever marry a Benjamite. But now they desperately needed to save the remnant. They found one town, Jabesh-Gilead, that had not joined the assembly for the war. They attacked it, killed everyone except 400 young virgins, and these women were given as wives to the 600 Benjaminite survivors. But it was still not enough. So they devised a shocking, pragmatic plan. During the annual festival in Shiloh, the girls of Shiloh will come out to dance in the vineyards. Let the remaining Benjamites hide themselves, and when the girls come out, each man must seize a wife for himself and carry her away. And that is what they did. The remaining Benjamites took their seized wives, rebuilt their towns, and returned to their land. And the book of Judges ends with a single damning sentence, a sentence that explains everything that has just transpired. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. The book of Judges is not merely history. It is a dark mirror held up to the face of a nation's soul. What began with the faithfulness and military success of Joshua's generation ended in moral, social, and religious chaos. They had the land promised to them. They possessed the law of God. They had the miraculous stories of deliverance. But they lacked one essential thing, a heart that remembered the covenant. We watched them win battles only to immediately fall into idol worship. They cried out to God in desperation, only to forget him once the relief came. Each judge, Othniel, Deborah, Gideon, Jephthah, Samson, brought a moment of hope, but each story reinforced the same destructive cycle. Disobedience, leading to disaster, leading to desperation, leading to deliverance, followed immediately by disobedience again. The cycle never broke. It only spiraled deeper into depravity. They did not just need a deliverer. They needed a king, not merely someone to save them from foreign enemies, but someone to lead their hearts and guide their souls. Not just a powerful warrior, but a shepherd. One who could finally break the devastating cycle of human failure for good. And centuries later, that true king would come, born not in a palace of power, but in a stable. He would ride not on a war chariot, but humbly on a donkey. He would wear not gold, but a crown of thorns. And he would defeat not just nations, but sin, death, and hell itself. His name was Jesus, the true and final judge, the king they longed for, and the king we still desperately need. The book of Judges ends in profound darkness, but it points inexorably toward the light. A people lost, and a God who never gave up on his story, waiting for the moment of redemption. And the question remains, in a world where everyone still insists on doing what is right in their own eyes, will you choose the way of the king?
My flat sings, wipers to the sky. Melodies flows gentle and free, carrying dreams across the sea. In every note, a piece of me, forever here in harmony. Flood sings, wipers to the sky. Melodies flows gentle and free, carrying dreams across the sea. In every note, a piece of me, forever here in harmony. Music lives inside my heart. music lives inside my heart.